Well, I have to say this is one of the warmest welcomes I've ever gotten, so thank you very much. Yesterday I gave a talk at Penn, and I have to tell you that was not a warm welcome. All right, so no offense, but you guys really have provided me a really warm welcome. I have to tell you, you know, I've traveled the country. I talked at different universities, different local governments, different school districts. And I have to say, I'm very, very impressed with the sort of synergy that's taking place here with particularly with the students of color that came together to organize this event, and specifically with ABLE, right? ABLE, Achieving Black Latino Leaders of Excellence. ABLE. I mean, let's think about the status of men of color in this country, young men of color, and let's think about the fact that one out of every three young men, one out of every three young black men that's the age of the young black men in the audience today, college-age young black men, in this country, one out of every three is either locked up or under the supervision of the criminal justice system. One out of every three. And so it is a dire, dire crisis in the black community, and also in the Latino community. Latinos don't suffer as much as African Americans in terms of incarceration, but they do suffer more than Anglo Americans, so they're sandwiched in between. So for Latinos, it's one out of every six, and for whites, college-age white males, it's one out of every 12. Okay? It's a dire crisis. In California, to give you an example, there are 22,000 college-age black men in college, but 44,000 college-age black men in prison. And it's not a question of whether young black and Latino men are more criminals, right? More prone to crime. It's a question of how we choose as a society to think about and label these young people. And specifically, I want us to rethink, even those of us who are progressive and going out and working with young people in the community, how we label them, right? Because how you label someone determines how you treat them. So if you label a young person as at risk, how are you going to treat them? As a what? As a risk. What do you do with risk? You let it free? Let it roam around the Swarthmore campus? You contain it. Right? And that is the history of mass incarceration in our country, that we've seen and labeled young, black, Latino, and poor youth as risks, and therefore we've decided to invest more in incarceration than in higher education. Now, a lot of people like to think that Pennsylvania and California don't have a lot in common. But I'll tell you one thing they have in common. For the first time in the history of both states, we spend more on prisons than we do on higher education. So as a society, we've decided consciously, our politicians have, voters have, decided, hey, we need to spend more taxpayers' money on incarcerating people than on educating people. And we spend $30,000 a year on average, in this country, to lock up one adult. Sometimes, in some states, like California, we spent $200,000 a year to lock up one juvenile. And the work I do with some of the youth out in the community who are in the neighborhood, these young men that I studied right here, I asked them all. In Oakland, California, ranked the second most dangerous city in California, ranked the eighth most dangerous city in the country. I asked these youngsters, I said, hey, they spend $30,000 a year on locking up an adult, one of you, when you turn 18. I said, if I were to give you each $30,000 a year, hypothetically, right, $30,000 a year to stay away from crime, drugs, violence, and to stay in school, would you do it? All of them said, hell yeah. And it is about economics. It is about support. It is about feeding young people. I've worked with some of the kids who are considered some of the roughest, most thuggish, most gang-banging individuals in the communities I've worked in. FBI has come in and gathered them up and imposed some racketeering and RICO charges on them because they're so criminal, right? And when I go out there to visit them, and I'm hanging out with them, I bring a bucket of chicken sometimes. And these are tough kids who have a lot of pride. Do you think they eat that chicken? No, I didn't think they would. Bring out a bucket of chicken, and I hang out in this alley with these guys. And at first, they're like. And then 10 minutes later, one of them grabs a wing, one of them grabs a leg, one of them grabs a breast. And before you know it, that bucket is empty. What's my point here? That some of these youngsters are just trying to survive. They're trying to eat. And as a society, right, we've labeled them as these big-time criminals who don't have the capacity to change. And the only way we're going to help them to change is to provide them basic needs like food and shelter, and then the next level of basic needs for those of you who have taken Psychology 101, right? The hierarchy of development. First you need food and shelter, then you need to feel belonging. And when these youngsters don't feel belonging, because of how we treat them as a society. And then you could reach self-actualization. So if we're not providing the very basics, what makes us think that they're going to want to go to college? So we have to start from a very basic foundation when we work with some of these young people. Now, this is the question I've been asking, and I wrote this book. I'll pass it around for you to check out. Trying to answer this question. What does it mean to grow up in a time where we invest more in prisons than we do on education? What does it mean for a young person who's growing up in the inner city where policing and zero tolerance is more important to people than actually educating them? After I wrote the book, I took it to the youngsters I was studying. I gave it to one of them. I said, I want you to be honest with me. Tell me what you think. He started reading it, and he said, it's all right, but it don't speak to me. My heart dropped, because here I am trying to write a book about these youngsters for these youngsters, and it doesn't speak to them. And that becomes a problem for us at the university, for us college students. When we go out, we bring in youngsters from the local community, but we don't know how to speak to them. And so I decided to write a book for them. It's a very basic book. It's my life story with little messages in it for them. So I'll pass this book around for you to look at. Now, to the young people in here, will you pass this around? To the young people in here, you're at some fancy college with this square. Some of you might be saying, man, who's this clown in the suit trying to talk about the inner city and the struggles that young people face? Well, let me tell you, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not supposed to be an author of two books. I'm supposed to be dead, 6 feet under, with a bunch of the homies I had to bury growing up. I'm not supposed to be a college professor in California, right on the beach. I'm supposed to be shooting up heroin, snorting meth, with a bunch of the friends I grew up with who are out there right now as I speak, robbing, stealing, just to get their next high. You see, young people, I'm not supposed to be here because from a young age, I told myself, school is not for me. Why do I want to go to school if it's not helping my mom, my single mom, pay the bills? You see, I never even met my father growing up. And so I gave up on school and on life from a young age. And I decided to just hit the streets and survive on the streets. Before you know it, as a teenager, going in and out of juvie. Before you know it, I experienced a lot of violence. Before you know it, my best friend gets murdered in front of me, shot in the head at age 15. And it's at this moment where I tell myself, I'm either going to end up in prison, dead, or maybe, just maybe, I could try to change my own life and the life of my family and my community and my people. And I started meeting like these college students, these nerds that would go out into the local community and bring a van and pick us up and take us to go see some people talking about some random stuff. And at first, I used to call them the Mormons. Because they would be like the Mormons that would show up on Sunday knocking on your door trying to convert you. They were trying to convert me, man. They were trying to take me out of my hood and take me to the college. And I wasn't having that. But then little by little, I started to pay a little bit of attention. I started to realize that this struggle, this thing about going to college is not about someone telling you, go to college, it's good for you. It's about you telling yourself that you want a change in your life, in the life of your family, in the life of your community, and that you will become someone important in life because that prominence, that power that you get from an education allows you to make the changes that you need to make in this society. So little by little, these college students started to mentor me. And little by little, I started to think about what it would be like to go to the university. Started going back into school, got my high school diploma, applied to college. One college, college students helped me apply to a state school. I get a letter a few months later, and it says, congratulations, you've been admitted to California State University. I had to rub my eyes. I said, man, what are these people smoking that admitted me into college? And then below it said, you've been admitted under probationary status. I said, probation? I'm already on probation. That don't matter. They weren't talking about like a cop following you around the classroom. They were talking about a special program that if you get a C or below, you end up getting kicked out of the school because they're giving you a second chance. So that's my point. Right? My point is this. It has to do with second chances. So if we have this crisis, which I told you about, right? Then what does it mean to provide young people with second chances? Someone provided me a second chance, and I ran with it. I flew with it. And what does it mean for you college students who are here and the resources and the privileges that you have to be able to spread them around? You see, you shouldn't feel guilty as college students for having privilege. If you're white, you shouldn't feel guilty for being white. But you should feel a knowledge, an understanding of your white privilege. And with that white privilege, do things that are right for people. And those of you students of color at the college who come from the oppressed community, guess what? You have privilege too. So you need to acknowledge your privilege. If you were to boil the world down to 100 people, only one out of those 100 people would have a college degree. So every single one of you in here who are enrolled in college and about to finish up, you have a privilege that surpasses many people in this world. And with that privilege comes an obligation. The obligation to help others. The obligation to empower the powerless. And the obligation to acknowledge our privilege. Before I move on, I'm going to show you just a couple-minute little video clip that talks a little bit about my experience and what the media has done with this experience.
Now, another in our series on the nation's high school dropout crisis. Tonight, one man's journey from gang member and dropout to professor, and his efforts to keep other young men from making his mistakes. Ray Suarez has our American graduate story.
My name is Victor Rios. In 1994, this was me. I was introduced to the nation in a Frontline documentary. I was a gang member, a juvenile delinquent, and a high school dropout.
But in the 18 years that followed, Victor Rios earned his high school diploma, finished college, earned a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, and wrote two books on his life and his research on juvenile delinquency. Okay. He now teaches sociology at UC Santa Barbara and helps at-risk youth navigate the perils of adolescence.
I'm sure you're closer to some people than others.
Rios is also a family man with a wife, Rebecca, and three children. Life is constantly busy.
To be this far into the future, I feel like I've lived two lifetimes.
There it is, two lifetimes. And that's what it's about, right? It's about taking these kids who are represented in the media as these criminals, these monsters, right? And providing them those second chances. Let me give you just a little bit of history on when we begin to really expand mass incarceration and lock up a whole generation of youngsters. This isn't old, okay? It's a new thing. Mass incarceration is a new thing. African Americans have been punished in different ways for the last few hundred years. Slavery, Jim Crow, this oppression in the ghettos, right? Brutality. But incarcerating an entire generation of young black men is a new thing, right? And this begins back in the 60s when we're trying to, the country is scared of these black radicals, the Black Panthers, Malcolm X, who are talking about taking over, right? And so there's this fear makes the government expand the criminal justice system to contain these radicals. Well, you fast forward 20 years, and this is where we get so many people locked up. But in the 1990s, we still weren't locking up enough juveniles. It was just adults we were locking up. So some politicians that wanted to run for president and wanted to make a career for themselves said, hey, there's a whole nother avenue to exploit. Let's start attacking the juvenile criminals. And these two professors, John DeLulio and William Bennett, created this idea of the super predator. And they said that young kids in the ghetto were super predators, and that they would come and kill everyone and rob banks and beat people down if we didn't do something about it. So all these magazines around this time, the media picks up on it and says, hey, the super predators are here, scary kids around the corner, a teenage time bomb. And it was making reference to black and Latino kids in the inner city. So how do we change this, right? We have to relabel people. Instead of labeling them a risk, we label them as a promise, right? A young person who's living in marginality is a young person that has promise. If we provide the right kinds of resources. So what does society think of these boys that I worked with in Oakland? Does society think they're at risk or at promise? At risk. Now I'm going to show you just some pictures of some of the kids I've worked with in Southern California now. So I went from Oakland to close to the LA area. And so on this day, I'm looking for these boys I'm studying, right? There's three of them, and these officers have assault rifles pointed at them. And then I took a picture, and then the assault rifle got pointed at me. And then they're like, the officers are like, hey, sit your ass down right here, right next to them. So I became the fourth person sitting down on that curb. Here's a picture of one of the boys taking a picture of an officer taking a picture of him. And they were doing photo voice, where they would go out and take pictures of things that impact them in the community. Surveillance is taking place in many communities. And then let me tell you a story of a young man named Tyrell to give you an example of what happens with some boys who get labeled and marked from a very young age. This young man, I met him when he was 15, and I followed him for 3 years. In fifth grade, he gets harassed by the police for being too tall. So one day, the police officer stopped him, and he said, I'm going to search you for drugs. And Tyrell says, officer, I'm only in fifth grade. Why would I have drugs on me? He's like, you're in fifth grade. You're too tall, man. You know, you look like a drug dealer. Here, let me search you. And then from then on, he would search him every other week to see if he had drugs on him. Then in sixth grade, he was in a bad mood, and he kind of mean mugged the teacher, just gave her a crazy look. She called the cops on him. In eighth grade, he decides to sell drugs because he says, if I'm going to get treated like a criminal, I might as well act like one. And here's the worst part. His family was pretty stable. His mom was living in public housing. But one day, the government decides, this is during a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, he decides to eliminate welfare for the poor in this country. And when he eliminates welfare, the poor no longer get public housing, not at least not as much as before, right? So his mom gets evicted from public housing, and so she hits the streets trying to survive, and before you know it, she gets addicted to crack cocaine. And Tyrell tells me, man, my mom smoked so much crack, she calls herself Bubbles. It's tragic. We blame it on people. We say, oh, those people, they're ignorant. Those people, they don't take care of their children. Those people, guess what? We need to take accountability of what the state, the government has done to poor people. Not providing them resources, networks, housing, and deciding these people are lazy, so let's take welfare away from them. And this is what gets created. Tyrell was so upset that his mom was addicted to crack and that the police never got rid of the crack dealer from this alley. This is called Death Alley. He was so upset at the crack dealer that he said, I'm going to take justice into my own hands and I'm going to beat this guy down and kick him out of the alley. So he beat the guy down. The guy left. 2 days later, he came back and shot and killed his little cousin. So on this day, Tyrell is mourning for his little cousin. And on his pants, you'll see right now, he has rest in peace. Suge, his little cousin. And so when the state isn't there to protect us, right, when the police aren't there to protect us, to get rid of that crack dealer, but instead are harassing us every day for just being kids growing up in the wrong place at the wrong time, right, there's a crisis. Because the police are there when we don't need them, but they're not there when we need them. And that's what many residents tell me. And this is a national crisis, right? Young Trayvon Martin, you remember this little young man from Florida that got shot by some random neighborhood watch guy? You remember that? Yeah, it's a national crisis. And what does the media say? Instead of the media saying, oh, poor kid, this guy, you know, he deserves to go to jail for killing this kid, the media says, this kid was too tall. Look at this. ABC News says, hey, even though he was 17, he was 6'3", so it's almost like he was an adult. And another media guy, Geraldo Rivera, claiming to be Latino, that man ain't Latino, claiming to be Latino, says it was because he was wearing a hoodie that he got killed. He shouldn't have been wearing a hoodie. That is cold. Look at this, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 officers. They go and pluck little guys, smaller than these guys, little 12-year-old guys from the line at the merry-go-round and lift their shirts up and humiliate them in front of the whole fair. This is at the fair, checking for gang tattoos. So these little youngsters are growing up not feeling safe around police, but feeling violated by police. And as citizens, we need to hold police officers accountable who are doing this kind of stuff, and the officers who are actually doing the right thing and connecting with the youth, we need to give them incentives, give them a raise, promote them, because there are a handful of officers out there that do know how to interact with the community in the right way. But the crisis is that the majority is not doing the right thing. Youngsters are, you know, this is a monitoring device for a youngster who's on probation. I asked them to take pictures of the things that affected them in the community, and they kept coming back with pictures of police. More police, more police, Here I took a group of kids, just like you guys brought some youth from, you know, I brought some youth out to UC Santa Barbara, and guess how we got welcomed? By getting pulled aside by the cops and getting searched, shirts off and everything, the kids did. So I went up to this officer, he's a university officer, my coworker, right? I'm like, hey, officer, I'm a professor here, man. These kids are with me. He looked at me, he goes, I don't care who you are. You need to leave before I arrest you. Remember earlier I was talking about power and making change with that power? I went to the chancellor of the university and complained. And I said, I want to be on the next, they were hiring a new chief. I want to be on the hiring committee for the chief of police. He put me on the hiring committee. We hired a new chief. When the chief arrived, his first day on campus, I met with him. I said, you have a problem, officer. He says, Dr. Rios, I'll take care of it. Guy's no longer on campus. So this is why we get an education. This is why we go and become professionals, right? Not to show off, right? But to help to make change, right? Even if it's little by little, right? To help to make change and improve the conditions that young people live in. Huh, who is this guy? It's kind of random. Does anyone know who this is? He looks like Poseidon. He's a relative of Poseidon. Yeah. Yeah, who said that? All right, tell us about Proteus. A shapeshifter. Oh, wow. Okay, what's that mean, man? He could turn into whatever he wants. Why do you think I'm bringing him up?
Change.
See, some of us who have resilience, some of us who are able to survive in different environments, the street, right? The university, school, you know, are able to do so because we have a kind of shape-shifting ability. And every young person has that ability out there. And it's up to us to help them hone in on that ability and to help them develop that ability to be like Proteus, right? To shift depending on the environment and the context in which you're in. To be like a chameleon, right? That you could be on the street and in your neighborhood and feel comfortable there and be proud of being who you are, but then that you could come into the university and be an intellectual, but then that you could go into the professional world and be a professional, and that it's okay to be who you are and where you come from. And that is the solution, right? So Proteanism, do you know about Proteanism? You do?
Well, I guess it's being like Proteus.
It's being like Proteus. Man, this place has some smart students. Proteanism is the ability to constantly change oneself in order to adapt to one's environment. Right? And if we could hone in, we could create programs, right, that help young people constantly shift so that they could adapt to their environment, then we're getting a step closer, right? A lot of people say, well, Dr. Rios, you keep saying the kids need to change. The kids need to change. What about the system? Well, we change youngsters so that they can change the system. Because I can't do it by myself. I'm not even going to do that. So how did I change my life around? My mentors helped me. My teachers helped me. What did they know that I didn't know? What did they know that many of us don't know? They knew that to help a youngster, you got to understand their social location. Let me ask the students here. Of all these college students that brought you here, how many of them hang out in your neighborhood? None of them? How many of them go to your school? None? Do college students ever come to your school to tutor, mentor sometimes? No? Not at your school? Y'all should be ashamed of yourselves. See, in order to help young people out, we have to understand where they're coming from. And the only way to understand where they're coming from is to be where they're at. So you need to take some field trips, college students. Genuine interest, I know I'm putting you down. I know some of you go to the prison and help inmates out. I know some of you go to other communities. So I want to acknowledge the work you already do, but also push you to do a little bit more, right? Demonstrate an interest in young people's learning, that they have the potential. I'm speaking to young people right now. Half of them are asleep. But guess what? Even in her little dream right now, right? I'm going to whisper in her ear some knowledge. And she's at promise to me. So what that means to me is that half of that message will get in there. And it's a little seed I'm planting, right? And that one day it'll just click. You know? It'll just click. And you know, I'm not upset that these youngsters are sleeping. You know why? They're showing me they're so comfortable around me. Right? I'm giving them so much love that they can feel like they could take a nap and feel safe. Right? How many of you can claim that? Consistency. We have to be consistent, right? If you're going to claim to go help young people out, right, you got to be there. Many young people who live in environments where resources are scarce, they're used to people coming in and out of their lives. Parents, a program that's going to come save them, the Mormons. I apologize, no disrespect to any Mormons in here. I'm just talking about the ones that come by on Sunday and try to convert me, right? Okay. So we have to be consistent. We have to make a commitment to be there, to see them through. Nurturing. We have to nurture them. We have to give them that love. We have to accept them for who they are, right? This little youngster's still sleeping. I got to be... right? Patient. I got to embrace them. I got to be nurturing. I got to be unconditional, right? So my teachers and my mentors believed in me so much that they tricked me into believing in myself. So we have to believe in people so much that it oozes out of us and it gets transposed onto them. And for those of you college students who are struggling, who are looking for an identity, who are on academic probation, who don't know what you're going to do with your life, right? For those of you, I tell you, believe in yourself and you will accomplish the unbelievable. So you too need a little nurturing sometimes. But keep doing the good work that you're doing. Keep believing in the fact that a liberal arts education will truly help you to change the world. So maybe I am supposed to be here, right? Giving you this message, telling you about my studies, telling you about the young people that I work with, but also telling you that everyone in here has that potential to make change in local communities, in people's lives. And for the young people in here, I'm very honored that you came. Thank you for paying attention, listening, being here present. And I look forward to seeing you in college one day and maybe even being your professor. Thank you very much for your time.